This episode of Datanauts is brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/datanauts and use the code datanauts30.
This episode is sponsored in part by CloudGenix. Join CloudGenix and the Packet Pushers for the SD-WAN Mixer at VMworld on August 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. Go to cloudgenix.com for details.
Welcome, my friends, and in this show, we're going to return to a topic that we covered previously on serverless architecture. We're going to dig deeper, we're going to delve into the murky, mysterious world of serverless, and we have someone who listened to the show who wanted to comment with the other side of the coin, so to speak, to make sure that our black hole of negativity doesn't draw anyone into the sadness panda that was around serverless architecture in the previous show. Get ready, strap in, set phasers to stun, and here we go. And welcome. I am Chris Wall. You can follow me at Chris Wall. And with me is my co-host, who has a hand-painted figurines of every Star Wars character stashed under his bed. He's Ethan Banks, at EC Banks on the Twitters. And this is the Datanauts podcast. You can find this and all of our shows on iTunes, in your favorite podcatcher, and at packetpushers.net. Welcome, Ethan. Are you recharged? Have you painted a new Star Wars character figurine recently, or...
I have not recently. I am recharged, though, and am pleased that we have a guest today to talk to us about serverless. And again, as you put it, the other side of the coin. The show we did was an intro, kind of getting a handle on the topic. And now we're going to hear more from the operational perspective, how serverless fits into the world. So I am pleased.
Yes. So today we have Brian Gracely on the show. Before he gets to ramble on about all of the various awesome things he's done, I just got to say, love his show on the Cloudcast. He does a great podcast with Aaron Delp around all things cloud. Longtime listener, really glad to have you on the show today, Brian. Can you tell us and our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Thanks, Ethan. Like you said, longtime listener and first-time caller. In terms of background, spent a long time at Cisco. So kind of can relate to most of the infrastructure stuff you guys are still talking about. Did everything from handling tech support calls in TAC to product management, systems engineering, ran their solution team for a long time. So used to be very, very hands-on, did a lot of architecture stuff. Since then, bounced around in the virtualization world, both at EMC and NetApp, and helped run their virtualization teams. Was over at Virtustream doing the service provider stuff, and then spent a little bit of time doing some analyst stuff at Wikibon, and now director of product strategy over at Red Hat here in Raleigh. First time working for a Raleigh company, working on the OpenShift team. So excited to be on the show and glad to be with you guys today.
Wow, what's that like actually working where you live? I know that's a new thing, right?
And it's weird, yeah. I've been in the tech industry for, 20-something years, and it's the first time the company I worked for was local. So yeah, it'll be an interesting adventure. I was thinking about it, I think around 96 or something, when I first started working at Cisco, there was sort of this thing where Red Hat was kind of getting started, Cisco was kind of taking off. And I remember one time kind of having a thing where I was like, well, I can learn more iOS or I can learn Linux. And at the time, iOS was sort of the right thing. And nowadays, it seems like Linux is more and more the thing. So it feels like the timing's sort of working out.
Sure. One kind of begets the other.
Yeah.
Well, first off, I wanted to thank you. You listened to the show and you wanted to come on as a guest. And that's certainly something we encourage to all the listeners. If you hear something that piques your interest and you want to talk more about it, please reach out to us. I thought it'd be good to start off by getting your take specifically on serverless, Brian. What's kind of your general thoughts on what it is and what piqued your interest on the previous show that you wanted to come on and talk about?
So a couple of things. You mentioned Cloudcast. So Aaron Delp and I have done that for a long time. We started hearing this word serverless and we were like, wow, what does that mean? And our show has always been about, if we don't understand something, we're going to go find some smart people and try and get smarter about it. And we did a couple of shows that were about serverless. We had a couple of people who were actually building serverless applications, using them for their business. And then we had a couple of people that were on the technology side of stuff. And a couple of things kind of jumped out at us. One was those shows for us, and they were in the last couple of months, were probably the most popular shows we'd had in 5 years. And so that sort of kicked off a light bulb for us. And there was like, okay, there's some interest in this. There's sort of real community interest in this. And maybe it was just a buzzword. And then there was kind of an interesting set of data points. So one of the guys said, hey, I've been using serverless for about a year or so. I'm saving about 80% on my AWS costs. And I went, oh, okay, that's a lot. That's interesting. And then about 3 weeks later, AWS got up during one of their summer keynotes for an AWS summit. And the guy from AWS giving the keynote was giving a customer testimonial and said, hey, so-and-so rebuilt an application and they're now saving 80% of their AWS cost. It was one of those things where I went, huh, if Amazon's willing to talk about their own customers saving that much money, essentially taking money out of their own pocket, it must be something that's kind of relevant. Big data, two data points. So that sort of piqued our interest. And then we've been digging into it a lot lately to the point I think we may end up spinning off our own sort of podcast focused on it. But to me, it's kind of a next evolution of what's going on in computing. It sort of forces you to think about like how are applications being developed. So it forces you to think about application patterns. Some little things like that have sort of piqued our interest to the point where we go, okay, what is this phenomenon? What's going on?
We as infrastructure engineers, we like, okay, we know how to do this thing. It was VMs. And now it's like, oh, we're learning containers. And then serverless comes along. And you mentioned evolution. So are we looking at an evolution of infrastructure and serverless is now the new thing that's going to replace all the other stuff? Or is it just like another tool in our toolbox?
So here's the way I think about it. Everybody's gone through this. You know, the last 2 years, we've all kind of gone through this thing where it was like Docker, 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 which of course beget the conversation was, do containers replace VMs? And people have different opinions on that. And you can determine their bias on stuff. But like, I look at it this way, applications are sort of changing. And the tools that people are going to want to use to make those things happen are going to kind of evolve. And let's sort of think about this evolutionary. VMs were great if you said, hey, I want to save a bunch of money. I'm underutilizing the compute resource that I have, but I need to keep my application exactly the way it is. I want to put it in a virtual machine and I want to gain some efficiency benefits. Okay, cool. So do that. It's got its pros and cons to doing it. Networking's more complicated. Storage is more complicated, but I get a benefit from it. And then there are applications that are coming along that you go, oh, well, I need them to spin up faster, right? So instead of waiting for Windows to boot and waiting 5 minutes, I need something that's going to boot up in half a second.
Hey, hey, Windows doesn't take 5 minutes to boot. It's like three. Okay, okay. Let's get this straight. Okay. Anyways.
That's right. So you start to have these new types of applications where you go, I just need compute for maybe a portion of time and I need it to be available really quickly. Or, you know what? It's a Linux-based application and I want to be highly efficient in how I use the compute. Containers start to make some sense. And then what we're seeing with serverless is basically there are types of applications that have emerged where somebody really goes, you know, all I care about is I have this function, I have this thing, some action happens, I want something else to then happen as a result of that. What if I could just make that happen? I don't have to even think about spinning up a container or spinning up a virtual machine. Like, I just want that thing to happen. And there's types of applications where that sort of makes sense. So it's not a linear evolution. It's not like containers replace VMs and serverless replaces containers. It becomes a thing where you go, look, applications are changing and you don't really have to know anything about applications to sort of make sense of this. All you have to do is go, well, in my pocket, there's now a supercomputing device that doesn't run Windows. It doesn't run Linux. It runs this other thing called either iOS or Android. And it's got a different way of computing, right? The network is different on a mobile phone and the operating system is different. So it makes sense that logically applications are sort of evolving because the things we're using are sort of evolving.
So I read a fair bit of PowerShell code and I was trying to put this in my world and my brain a little bit.
Right.
So I write the code and essentially I need a Windows platform to run it and execute it and give it inputs and receive outputs. So this would be like saying, here's the chunk of code, just execute it and give me an answer. And I don't really care about the underlying infrastructure, just here's the function I'm trying to run.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
When I reached out to you guys, my intention was not to say like, hey, you got it all wrong. It was sort of, you got a portion of it right, but let me try and expand what the domain looks like these days. So let's take a couple of those things. So take PowerShell, for example. If you look at AWS Lambda, so a lot of the what you guys talked about in the last show was Amazon Lambda.
Right.
That's probably the most mature of all the sort of serverless types of things out there. But for example, like Microsoft has something called Microsoft Functions. It's a thing that lives in Azure. It's pretty new. It's kind of still in beta. But in essence, you can have functions that are nothing but PowerShell, right? So in Lambda, it's JavaScript, it's Node, it's Python. Like, it's kind of Linux specific to a certain extent, although that's evolving. But there is a Microsoft sort of version of this for Windows. So if you go, well, what do I do in my PowerShell scripts, for example? Well, I'm trying to do things that probably are going to be repetitive. Maybe from an ops perspective, it's, you know, do something and deploy some code, or do something and ask for a response, or something gets put in a database, you're listening to that database, and then as a result of that, you want something to happen. You want to send off a text message to ops to say, hey, do something, or you want to update a dashboard or something. All it's doing is saying, hey, look, Chris, instead of you having to worry about maintaining that server where the PowerShell is going to run, or thinking about, do I have to spin up a container or a VM? It just goes, you just want the PowerShell to run, and I want it to run somewhere maybe 1,000 times in a row, or maybe once. That's kind of where that's going. And we're seeing this evolution of all the different kinds of ways that you can do serverless stuff that is going to incorporate lots of different languages, lots of different frameworks, stuff like that.
Yeah.
It serves a specific kind of function, right? If you want to run a function as opposed to a long-running application, it might make sense. It's a tool in the toolbox, like Ethan said.
Isn't that platform as a service, essentially? You're saying, here's a place where I can run code, and I just throw it at it and say, give me a result, and it comes back?
Yeah, that's a really good point. This is the joys of the hype cycle of computing. So in all reality, serverless, you know, the idea that you go, hey, I want to not have to worry about the infrastructure, it's very easy to go, gosh, that sounds exactly like platform as a service. And I think in reality, what we'll see is serverless will become sort of just a feature of what these evolving platform as a services look like. And in reality, where the market is today, so if you just sort of go through the marketplace, let's walk through a couple of these. So like IBM has what's called Bluemix. That's their PaaS platform. You can run it on premises, you can run it in the cloud. And now they have something called OpenWhisk. OpenWhisk is their version of serverless or functions as a service. It's a feature that runs kind of in parallel to their PaaS platform. You can think about AWS Lambda as being part of the AWS application suite. Well, that simply means it's part of the PaaS. So you're right. It's a function that is there to help developers or anybody who sort of just kind of wants to abstract that infrastructure from the task they want to do.
So interesting.
And again, part of it is, it's funny, even the people who build PaaSes, so whether you're Cloud Foundry or OpenShift or whoever, you hear a lot of them going like, oh, I don't want to say we're a PaaS anymore. I want to say we're a platform. And part of that's because PaaS got popular with things like Heroku, and then it kind of faded a little bit. And so there's always that like, hey, what's cool and new, and does something have some stink on it? And to a certain extent, PaaS, at least over the last few years, that term had a little bit of a stink on it, even though it was sort of evolving. And so you're hearing people talk more and more just platform or serverless or whatever the new sort of buzzy thing is. But at the end of the day, it's, I want to do something. I don't want to have to think about scaling, or I don't want to have to think about infrastructure. And you go, okay, well, that's still probably PaaS. Call it whatever you want.
Yeah, fair enough. When I think PaaS, I still go back to the biggest example that I tend to draw against is Pivotal. You know, the fact that they've got quite a very popular PaaS offering that's typically kind of the poster child, I think, for that space. Would they also be shifting, do you think, to something like, are we calling it FaaS now, or is serverless still the thing?
Yeah, so let's break that down. So to a certain extent, take something like Cloud Foundry. It could very easily, it doesn't today, but it could very easily start to add a functions as a service or a serverless component. Like, here's one of the things, we can go back to sort of the Lambda example, and this is probably something that'll evolve into all of them. Like in the serverless world, for example, you can't run a function that lasts more than 5 minutes. So for example, you're not going to run these sort of long running big data types of Hadoop things where you go, oh, I'm going to run a 24-hour genome cycle trying to figure out some sort of thing, right? It's something that has to be very short run. And so you go, okay, there's certain applications or types of things you want to do that are only going to be short run, versus maybe you say, look, what do I do for applications that run consistently for very long periods of time? Well, those are the things that you might put in a container, you might leave in a VM, but you still want the PaaS platform to do things like auto-scale it or just make sure that it's highly available. It is one of these things where you do have to get a little bit above the infrastructure in terms of saying, well, what does the application do, right? You don't have to know the language of the thing, but you kind of have to go, well, what's the application sort of need, or what's it do? And then does it make sense to run it in a PaaS, or is it really just purely a function that runs short term? Well, maybe that could run in one of these serverless, on-premise, public cloud types of services.
You've mentioned earlier that we tend to think in binary terms, which I totally agree with. I find myself doing that too. Like, does it kill the old thing or not, right? And, that's where my brain is kind of at, is, okay, which one is better? And again, I need to take that step back and say, well, that's not really the question. It's which technology is better for this particular service or application. It sounds like the duration and lifecycle of what it's trying to do, like you said, 5 minutes for a function. That's like the old gray-haired function. It's time to retire that thing. In contrast, that's how long it takes in your world for Windows to boot. So
well,
there's a big difference there.
Yeah, let's put this into like real context instead of talking about sort of fluffy stuff. The way it was best explained to me was I had a guy named Joe Emison, who someday you may want to have on the show, super smart guy, runs his own company, happens to be here in North Carolina. But he said, look, here's the deal. As people shifted from using the browser as their primary kind of thing on their laptop is how they interacted with applications to mobile devices, you sort of go, oh, okay, well, what's the shift there? Well, the shift was the browser interacts with applications a certain way. Like the browser is sort of a front end. It's kind of a lightweight shim. And then there's lots of functionality on the back end of an application. In a mobile device, especially if you use a native mobile app, not just the web browser, what that does is because you typically have far less network bandwidth because you have to assume you're going over the mobile network, you end up saying, oh, well, I'm going to have to put way more functionality in the client. You've inverted the model of thin client, thick backend to going, oh, well, I have to have a thicker client and I'm going to be cognizant of the network and how many packets I have to pass back and forth and how many messages and retries and stuff. What's sort of happening is people are going, okay, I got to get back to thinking about a heavy front end and I want to optimize how much I have to send over the network. So let's make that backend function, that backend application, fairly lightweight. And gosh, if I can have a lot of that stuff sort of taken care of myself, that would be great. If I'm a developer or even if I'm an ops person, like that would be great. And that kind of became the early impetus for why people started doing this serverless stuff is they just said like, I don't want to have to think about scaling. Like, oh, there's a thing that will do scaling for me. Oh, that's cool. But it wasn't just there's a new cool thing. It was the computing paradigm has sort of shifted again. And it shifts all the time. We've seen it from mainframes to PCs to whatever. It shifted again. So people that ran the applications and were trying to optimize the application said, I got to shift again. And serverless kind of became this natural progression on the back end of a lot of those native mobile app applications.
You know, the thing that was kind of comforting to me is that Brian pointed out this is not a binary evolution. In other words, it's not like, containers are already boring. We're moving on to serverless now. See y'all later, infrastructure people. Bye-bye. It's not that kind of a thing. VMs have a home and containers have a home and serverless has a home. And a lot of what's driving what the right home is how the application is architected. It's not like serverless is leaving containers behind and containers left VMs behind. They all have a role to play in our infrastructure. And it's just up to us as ops folks to keep up with that and understand how things fit into the world. And maybe it's annoying that there's so much new technology that we have to keep up with. But at the same time, it's good that the things we're learning are still useful and have a home. What did you pick up on, Chris?
Well, I definitely like functions as a service or FaaS better than serverless. It just doesn't make my tooth ache when I say it. And I also liked hearing about Microsoft's Azure Functions, ability to potentially run the functions I write in PowerShell just as a thing. Right now I use AppBear, and we talked about that in the previous show, where it spins up a VM running Windows and then loads my code and runs it and displays the output. And sure, that works. It's a bit heavy and takes a little while. But the idea of just being able to like throw my code like spaghetti against the FaaS wall and seeing what comes out of it would be pretty cool. So I'm digging that. I needed to dive into it a little deeper.
Datanauts has great sponsors that make the show possible. One of them is IT Pro TV. I know you've heard from them before, but based on my review of their site, content, and delivery system, I believe it's a solid certification training platform. There's lots of content there, well over 1,000 hours, and you can consume it any way you want to, including devices like Roku and Apple TV. You can even buy via Amazon Video Direct if that appeals to you. The training material offered is likely what you're looking for. Microsoft Server 2016 MCSE. Check. Certified ethical hacker. Check. Cisco CCNA security. Absolutely. And lots more. And it's not just training, by the way. IT Pro TV also throws in over 100 labs, as well as Transcenter practice exams, so that you have a pretty good sense of when you're really ready to make an official exam attempt. With IT Pro TV, you don't buy a course. You get access to the entire library via a reasonable monthly subscription. Both individual and group pricing options are available. If you change your mind or cash gets tight, you can cancel with no hassle. Check out itpro.tv/datanauts to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 per year, but we have a special offer.
Try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code DATANAUTS30 to check out their courses, live stream, and more. You'll also receive 30% off the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. Just visit itpro.tv/datanauts, use the code DATANAUTS30, and try it free for 7 days, plus save 30% off the life of your account.
So, Brian, in the first show, it was kind of two crusty op dudes taking a stab at the world of serverless, just trying to, you know, wrap our brains around what's really going on there. Because, of course, the joke was, and kind of what we led in that show with, was that meme that was going around Twitter for a while, serverless is made of servers. Ha ha. But like you, we wanted to dig into a topic we were unfamiliar with, like you guys do on Cloudcast, and just sort this thing out. Okay, from an ops infrastructure perspective, can you help us get a handle on what architecture is being used for, you know, serverless architecture is being used for in production, and maybe anchor us back to the servers we know and love and the infrastructure we're taking care of, whether that's VMs and containers, and how serverless fits in? What do we have to think about?
I think the first thing to think about is, let's sort of take away the serverless term and some of the serverless piece. So there was a couple of things that you talked about that I thought were worth expanding on. You are absolutely correct that today, most of the serverless stuff tends to be public cloud-based. If you're an ops person, there's this inherent thing to go, oh, crap, it's the public cloud. Somebody else is taking care of all this stuff, like plugging in stuff, cabling stuff up. But it doesn't completely replace the fact that somebody still has to monitor stuff. In some cases, you can definitely have a hand in what the architecture looks like for availability and backing stuff up and trying to optimize the network. So the first thing, I guess, from an ops person way of thinking about this is it's not pure doom and gloom. Like there's still definitely a need for ops to be doing something depending on what types of services you use. The second way to think about it is, like we talked about earlier in the show, forget about serverless. Just think about going like, okay, there is this stuff like platform as a service, right? Again, it's just an abstraction of what's going on. And just like we talked about before, platform as a service can run in the public cloud and maybe somebody else runs it for you, but you could also run it yourself. And it can also run on-prem. And so if you're an ops person, you go, okay, well, let's say our company decides they want to run a platform as a service because they want to make something simpler for developers. I'm still going to have to get involved with that. I'm still going to have to make sure the IaaS layer under the covers is doing what it's doing, which means I better be pretty good at automating underlying infrastructure. I better start to understand when people say, what does an API do as opposed to what does a CLI do? Because API has sort of become the evolving automated CLI. And then you start saying like, well, okay, what are all those other things that ops has to do? Well, I got to do monitoring. I got to do troubleshooting. I've got to do, you know, capacity planning. I've got to figure out load balancing. So it doesn't really, really go away. You just have to sort of be okay with saying like, look, it's the stuff that was, you know, rack and stack stuff that, yeah, that's going away. But we've been talking about that for 5 or 10 years. Like that's not a differentiated function, but everything else still is super important. And there's still just things that you have to do to make it work.
There's a point I want to drill in here too, which is when I was digging into this, I didn't see a serverless architecture that you could run privately. It did all seem to be public cloud, but you're kind of implying here that like you can do public cloud and you can do private cloud, you could do private serverless, but think of it more as platform as a service kind of architecture?
Yeah. So one of the tricks with our industry is obviously some people are better at marketing than others. So Amazon does an awesome job and they were first. I mean, they were probably a year plus ahead of everybody else about talking about this thing. But just to give you some examples of stuff that can run on-prem, IBM came out with kind of an open source version of serverless. They call it OpenWhisk. That can run anywhere. You could run that on-prem. You could run that using somebody else's computers in the cloud. There's technology like iron.io, which is another company that's been around for a long time that makes essentially software that emulates these serverless kind of functions. Azure has something called Azure Functions. And if you know, you sort of follow the Azure roadmap, they've got something called Azure Stack, which is coming down the road. I think it's going to be in sometime in 2017. And they've sort of said, hey, what you're going to be able to do in Azure, you're going to be able to do on-premise with Azure Stack. So I think it's like with everything, a lot of times the newest stuff tends to pop out in the public cloud because it's new. And if it's driven by developers, sometimes they don't want to think about it. But over time, businesses come along and go, hey, that sounds really beneficial to me. And I have business needs that require things to be on-prem. So yeah, there is this evolving, it doesn't all have to be public cloud.
It's about the architecture and delivering functions as a service platform, whatever we're going to call that. A platform in which people can iterate their code quicker. You know, not having to wait a minute or 5 minutes or whatever to instantiate the workload so that we can start doing meaningful work and all of the complexity and headache that goes around that. It's just saying, here's a place where you can make cool stuff. And going back to an earlier comment, you're talking about people still need to plug in cable. Nope, nobody ever wants to cable servers and rack and stack. Like, that's the menial job that no one actually wants to do. So I think we're all fine with that going away for the most part. Plus, you see those horrible cable spaghetti environments on the, you know, like the cable shame Twitter feed, things like that. So yeah, I do feel that there is a lot more meaningful work that can be done. But I don't know. We've been talking about on-prem versus off-prem and that there's value in both. You have to instantiate that. But would the tasks necessarily be the same for ops in both? Because I'm imagining it's a little more of a black box when we start consuming other people's computers, you know, public cloud.
Right.
And it's a lot less of a black box, easier to monitor perhaps when it's on-prem. Doesn't that kind of change the role of ops in some way?
Well, yeah. I mean, to a certain extent, the role of ops is definitely changing as more stuff becomes a black box. So for any of these things that are sort of buzzworthy, whether it's even infrastructure as a service, to a certain extent, isn't the same as directly managing computers. Virtualization started doing that. Infrastructure as a service where you're giving out self-service capabilities to people, PaaS starts to do that. So it's in that same vein of stuff for ops. But at the end of the day, you know, like I saw an interesting stat the other day that said, if you go look at stuff like Dice and LinkedIn and these, you know, different things, like for every one person that identifies as sort of a DevOps person, sort of the ops side of a DevOps person, there's 30 developers out there, right? So it's sort of 30-1 at this point. And we all know developers don't really want to do ops, even if they have a cool DevOps t-shirt.
No, they never do.
No, DevOps really should be ops, right? It's the dev is silent. You know, it's the ops movement that says, hey, if developers have to go faster and I'm going to get blamed for things, I better figure out how to sort of keep up. It's always the balance. Like, going faster always sounds great, but how do you make sure that you keep the guardrails up? The analogy I guess I use is everybody became familiar with a CLI. And if you're in ops, you know some CLI, whether it's like a Cisco CLI or a Juniper CLI or a F5 CLI. The thing that you're going to have to become familiar with is, how do I deal with an API? Because the API is going to become the new CLI. It's going to become the thing that helps you interact with the system, because it is going to be kind of abstracted in some way. And that abstraction is there not because it's cool technology. It's there because if part of your system, hence the developers, or even just the business thing, is going really fast, you've got to be able to kind of keep up somewhat with that speed. That's more of what it is. It's less whatever the name is, serverless or PaaS or whatever. It's keeping up with the system, kind of having inputs and outputs being similar types of speeds.
Are we going to get locked in with a particular kind of serverless architecture? Because I'm guessing Lambda is different from OpenWhisk, which is different from Microsoft Functions, et cetera. You had said, I think maybe we were talking offline, Brian, but you said there is some amount of portability depending on how you write the code. But it always seems like when you pick something, you're kind of stuck with it for a long time. Is serverless going to put us in that box again?
It's a great question. You brought it up on the last show, and I was kind of like, okay. In terms of like writing the functions themselves in pretty much all of these things are just code. Right. I mean, think of them as either being like code, like it's some Java code or .NET code or, you know, whatever code it is, or it's like a script, you know, it's like a bash script or a PowerShell or something. So that part of it really isn't locked in. You could take that, you could put it in something else. For the most part, those are going to be completely portable. Where you're going to get locked in is if you start going, oh, well, my application uses this database and it can only use that, you know, it's sort of, I wrote all this logic code, whatever you want to call it, to use that database. And if that database happens to be an AWS database, then yeah, you're kind of locked into that. But I'll put it this way, like it's not any more of a lock-in than it is you choosing any sort of technology where you kind of go, oh, okay, it's above the infrastructure. So it's not Ethernet or it's not TCP/IP. And you're saying like, I care about the database, or I care about some logic within an application, a queue or a message bus or something like that. It's people being comfortable more at the application level with saying, am I okay with this or not? Because in some cases it's perfectly fine because you're like, oh, it's cost effective and it's fast and it's available. The other real big lock-in, I guess, and you know, lock-in is a relative term, is if you put all of your data in some place, moving your data someplace else, whether it's on-prem to off-prem or private cloud or public cloud anywhere else, like that's the heavy lifting because data's got that gravity element. It's hard to move terabytes and terabytes of data. But the other part, it's no more lock-in than we've had using an AWS or Azure infrastructure as a service level stuff, or VMware for that matter.
It's interesting hearing that conversation around, regardless of where you're consuming FAS, there's a need from an operations perspective to understand how to do important things like managing, monitoring, and ultimately empowering your team to consume those services, right? So there's a value in learning the process, regardless of it being on-prem or a cloud environment, whatever it may be. The locality's less important, it seems. It's going to change things a little bit, but there's a base set of skills that has a lot of value for the business, regardless of where you're going to run a FAS. Ethan, what are you thinking?
Speaking of base set of skills, Brian said something that really caught my attention, especially coming from a networking background. The API is the new CLI. Oh boy, we're so used to the CLI when we on the network side configure stuff. Not that we're not used to it on the server side. Certainly there's lots of command line interfaces that we live and breathe. But knowing how to access an API, perform a REST call, format it in a particular way, and get back a data set and do something with that data is a skill that you really need to have, because so much of what's out there is accessible via an API. And eventually there's going to be an expectation that, yeah, you know how to interact with an API. The thing being, it's not hard. Chris, you and I were talking about this. Yeah, it's very easy to sit down with, say, a Python script. And there are REST commands that make it very easy to interact with something. And you need to learn how to read the API documentation and therefore format your REST call correctly and then understand the data that's coming back at you and how to parse it and do something with it as your script continues. It is a skill, but it's not an insurmountable skill by any means. And if Brian's right, the API is the new CLI, it's going to be a have to have as opposed to a nice to have pretty quickly.
This episode is sponsored in part by CloudGenix. Join CloudGenix and the Packet Pushers for the SD-WAN Mixer at VMworld on August 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the MGM Grand Centrifuge Lounge. Come and hang with CloudGenix and Greg Farrow and Ethan Banks from the Packet Pushers to discuss what an SD-WAN application-defined branch looks like. There'll be free food and drinks, plus t-shirts and giveaways. Make sure to register at cloudgenix.com. That's CloudGenix.com. This is an event you don't want to miss, so go register right away. And now, back to the conversation.
Well, I'm pretty impressed so far with what you're saying about functions as a service, serverless, whatever we're going to call it for the marketing term today, Brian. It's nice to see some actual use cases, the idea of the cost going down by 80-something percent, which, you know, it's all relative, but to have the company that's earning the money saying you can save money by consuming a different portion of their offering tells me that they're going to make some kind of money out of it, but it's certainly something they want to encourage people to flock to. Let's go back into the future of serverless as it relates to the ops team. Now, we've talked about some skills that you need, the fact that on-prem versus off-prem doesn't necessarily affect it, but let's delve a little deeper into serverless, in your opinion, how that affects the ops team going forward.
A couple of basic things. Number one, it should force the ops team to sort of get together with an application group, developer group, whatever, and be like, you know, what are you doing? Not just, are you throwing me a virtual machine and I'll just run it for you? But like, what are you doing? Because the thing about it is, the serverless thing, think about it as, let's say it runs in the public cloud, just for example. If it's running in the public cloud, you might say, okay, how are you doing authentication of the service? How are you monitoring the service? You know, where are you storing the data elements of it? Is it files? Is it static images? That's a place where the ops folks are going to start going like, okay, I should start investigating how I'm going to do ops functions, right? Does that mean I have to go figure out some other public cloud services that would sort of augment this really well? So as an example, if you're going to authenticate the users that interact with a serverless application, if the serverless thing is running, for example, like on AWS Lambda, AWS has a native authentication service. And you might go, oh, okay, that's cool. Should ops run that authentication service because it has security implications, compliance implications? Or you might say, no, you know, we don't love that service. It doesn't do the thing we want. We want to use something like Auth0, which is a SaaS application, super easy to use. But again, it's operations saying like, is that a function, that a task that we should own as part of an application, just like we own the Active Directory server or we own the LDAP server or something. So there's a part of this where ops should be going, okay, I should know a little bit more about the application because I should be involved with the ancillary or augmented things that are around it. The other thing is, if your development team is starting to use some of these serverless things, one of the big areas where it's kind of lacking today is in monitoring. And the reason it's lacking in monitoring is because these functions don't run very long. So the ability to monitor something that's not there very much, especially when a lot of monitoring stuff tends to be agent-based or something else, you have to install something, that's an area where it's still very lacking. And you may have to start getting creative working with the dev team to go, how do we make sure your thing's gonna run the way it runs? Because, you know, just getting the basic services from an AWS or anybody else might not be enough. I've got to know more about what's going on. So it should be sort of a forcing function to where the ops team may be working even more closely with the dev team to understand what the application does and where they can add value.
I love that you're saying that. That's been one of the platforms, the planks of this show has been silo busting, making sure that everyone that's involved in an application delivery infrastructure is talking to one another, that within silos, infrastructure silos, that networking is talking to security, who's talking to storage, who's talking to virtualization, that all those folks are together. But then also the dev people that are building applications, we're talking to those folks and having those conversations as well. And this isn't a new thing. That's that we treat it like it's a new thing, but this goes back all my years in IT, and many times I've had to go back to a dev and explain to them. I gave a guy some bad news one day as he came complaining to me about how slow his application was running at this particular site. And I'm like, dude, you did all your testing on the LAN where you had all kinds of bandwidth. Now you're pumping this thing over T1. Here's a packet capture of your SQL data set that's coming back to you. And he went, oh. And had that conversation been happening earlier, it wouldn't have been such a big issue because he would have understood the infrastructure. We would have understood the demands of his client server app and could have avoided some problems before that app went into production. Just another conversation builder here. Okay, Brian, I just went on my silo busting rant thing. How do we bridge that gap? What skills do I, as an ops person, what do I need to have so that maybe I can speak the appropriate lingo?
I think instead of me going on a long rant, I would almost offer folks that listen to your show, go back and listen to the Scott Lowe show that you guys just did. A lot of the things that make sense in terms of skills are all the same thing that Scott's been talking about. So you probably should know a little bit of Linux, and not because maybe you should just learn Linux for Linux sake, but a lot of this new stuff is sort of coming out first and foremost on Linux. So you kind of want to understand some of that stuff. But more importantly, I would say, when everybody talks about, well, it's got an API, you talk to the API, that basic concept of, well, how do I talk to an API? What do you do to talk to an API? Does it have a CLI thing? Is it the language you talk to? Is it a whatever? There are lots of really good things, tutorials about how do I interact with what's called a REST API? And if you can kind of understand what that is, and it might mean that you have to learn a little bit of Python, it might mean you learn a little bit of some language, but it's typically something that's not super hard if you've done some scripting. Now, all of a sudden, you're going to be able to go, oh, okay, that thing has an API. I can kind of talk to it. I can query it. I can find out what metrics are available to me. I can potentially tell it to do something through the API, just like you used to tell a system to do something through a CLI. Those are the most basic things. And then the other part would be, and everybody goes, well, I'm in ops. I'm not a developer. I don't know anything about applications. Well, you probably should start learning the basics of kind of application architectures. You know, you talked about client server, which means I know which way the packets flow. Learn what a mobile application starts to look like. Where do packets flow? Where are there places you can cache stuff? Where are there places where you can, you know, modify what goes over the wire versus not? Those basic skills, I think, they're just natural evolution. But if you're not afraid of that stuff, like, you're going to be very, very valuable in those conversations where you're trying to do silo busting.
Wow, that really hits home. One of the presentations that I do all over the place is around PowerShell and RESTful APIs. And the first question I have is, how many people know what an API is? And typically I get a small number of hands that go up. And then I say, how many of you have actually called a RESTful API? And it's typically 0 to 2 hands, tops. You know, it's very, very small. So that's one thing that I tend to preach is, it's not hard. You can do it. No one was born knowing how to call a RESTful API. Everyone had to learn it, but it's certainly a valuable skill. My question now would be, okay, we've talked around serverless and FAS. How much time is on the death clock, so to speak? You know, when is this going to become, when do I need to know this? And it's going to be a requirement to keep my job.
I think in reality, just to make it relative, you know, if we wound back the clock like 2 years, somebody would go, hey, there's this Docker thing, and I read about it somewhere, and now 2 years later, it's like, oh, okay, you know, containers are kind of a thing. It's kind of a big buzzy thing. You know, serverless is kind of in that same time frame. It's very, very early. There are some people that are the earliest of early bleeding edge people, but it's got a long runway similar to what Docker is. But I think the way to look at this stuff is a lot of the new stuff is going so fast. You know, maybe it used to have like a 5-year window where you could kind of go, hey, I could jump in at any point in time. Now the window tends to be like about 2 years before it becomes something that you go, oh, my business might actually want to use this. So you've got some time, but like I said, I think some of the ancillary skills, you know, the API stuff, you should start learning regardless, whether you're talking about FAS or PaaS or even just infrastructure as a service.
One of the concerns that could be raised here, Brian, is how do we add value as OS people without being like those guys? Oh, gosh, you know, the friction, trying to avoid that.
Yeah, I think the way to think about that is there's kind of a framework that we kick around a little bit from a guy named Simon Wardley. The way he explains it is, if you look at any company, take a bigger company, if you're talking about two-person shop, like everything's irrelevant, but if you look at a big company, whenever they want to change, there's always people that are kind of the leading edge people. They're kind of the pioneers, right? And in this case, it might just be a couple of developers and they don't really need ops to help them. They kind of figure out some stuff. They do a basic proof of concept application. And then you get what are kind of the more mainstream thing, which is what we call sort of settlers, which is the people who go, okay, I took the lighthouse, but I now have to make it mainstream. I have to make it so it fits into our day-to-day processes and can scale out for the whole business. That's where ops can play a huge role, is to go, okay, maybe I'm not going to say no or get in the way of those early, crazy, early proof of concept people, but I do want to go pick their brain. Like, I want to learn, what'd you guys figure out? What worked? What didn't work? And then for most of the ops teams, like what they're very, very good at doing is going, how do I make this work, get from idea to scale to production? And I think just being aware of what some of those early things are doing and then kind of actively thinking about, okay, how do I make this work beyond just two people? How do I make it so it's going to kind of fit into a broader thing? Like, that's the way to think about that. Be the settler in the sort of pioneers, settlers, and then town planners paradigm. Because those early devs, they're the lighthouse people, they don't really know how to scale it to go to a big company. They just know how to get that first proof of concept to work. They're going to get somebody's boss excited about something. And then you can come in and be the people who go, hey, I know how to make this work so that 100 developers could work on it, or anybody in the company could take advantage of this service and, you know, roll it out across the country or globally or something.
And Brian, you said something that was key there to me, which is you might actually have to go and talk to other people, which sometimes it's so much easier just to kind of sit in our chair or hide behind our Slack avatar and not really reach out to other folks. But over the years, I've had really good luck saying, hey, I know you're working on this project and someone asked me to stand up some infrastructure for you to support this thing. You mind if I come over and we talk about the project just so I can get a better idea of what you're doing and make sure we're building out the right thing? And I've never had a problem with those conversations. People are like, sure, let's get on my calendar and let's have a seat and grab a whiteboard and talk through it and see what we can do. Yeah, some people are busy and maybe there's a little bit of stress there, but if you approach it in an open, I just want to help. Let's make this thing better for the company. I want us to work as a team and make this thing successful. For the most part, I've had really good luck with that and no complaints.
Yeah, no, it's great advice. And I think if you go in and you say, look, I just want to listen. I just want to watch and I want to observe and listen and sort of fight the inherent, kind of thing to go, oh, there's a no in there somewhere. There's a but, you know, and but in there somewhere. Just let that go for a little while. Get the proof of concept to work. See if it solves a business problem and then jump in and figure out how to be helpful. You know, that's great advice.
All right. I think my brain is now running functions as a service. They're booting up quickly and it's time to close the show. We could go on forever in this and I would love to, but let's cap it here and keep the audience wanting more. Brian, you provided a ton of links to really good content, techie stuff, ops perspectives, various conferences you can go to. We're going to bake all of that into the show notes. But if you could plug where you're at on social and your podcast, I'd really appreciate it.
Sure. At B. Gracely on Twitter is mine directly. If anybody wants to reach out, the Cloudcast is at thecloudcast.net. And then this new thing that we're going to do starting probably 1st of August or first week of August or so is at serverlesscast. So it'll end up being serverlesscast.io whenever we get the website up. But if anybody's interested in throwing ideas to us in terms of, hey, I want to learn more about that, shoot it over to us. And we'd love to get something put together, help educate the community.
thumbs up. And they've done hundreds of podcasts. I was lucky enough to be on one a couple years ago on NSX, and really great quality. I can't say enough good things about this show.
Thank you.
No problem. So that's it for today's edition of the Data Knots podcast. If you're a social creature, you can follow me. I'm at Chris Wall on the Twitter. So my blog is wallnetwork.com. And my snazzy friend Ethan, he's at EC Banks on the Twitters. And his blog is ethancbanks.com. For more of that delicious Data Knots show that you love, where we talk about infrastructure engineering, do a nosedive down the rabbit hole that is packetpushers.net, and you're going to find lots of wonderful things on containers and conferences and certifications, clouds, full stack engineering, so much more. Until then, my friends, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed. Like, I bought a car, I'm locked into it. Ah.
That's right. Damn it, I'm using Ford. They have the round steering wheel and nobody else does.